Welcome again to another episode of Adam's Corner. On this episode, I am lucky enough to be conversing with a legend in the special makeup effects field and special effects in general, I guess you would say. Mr. Rob Berman is joining me. His father is the Tom Berman, who a lot of us knew growing up as the guy who created special effects for such films as The Beast Within and Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and we could go on and on and on. Those are just, that's just tip of the iceberg, but that's just enough to get us started here. But basically, I'm going to let you take it from here and just tell us a little bit about, you know, how you came to be involved. I mean, it seems like a logical progression to get involved with your father's work, but maybe that wasn't always the case. And what, you know, you can tell us about some of your earliest memories of your father and working with him and how that all got started. And so, you know, if I'll let you take it from here.
Sure, no problem at all. You know, I never really was a fan of this kind of stuff. Not that I didn't like it, because I loved those kinds of movies and things like that, but I've never been a fan type person, mm-hmm. you know? When my father got into the industry, he got in because it was a well-paying job that he could raise his family with, you know? So he wasn't a fan either, you know? We'll go back and we'll talk when my grandfather used his inheritance money, because his parents died young. He used the inheritance money to go to art school. And so he went to the Chicago Art School, and that's where he met my grandmother, and they went back to Nebraska. And my grandfather became a local sculptor, and he started doing monuments. I mean, big, giant, 26-ton concrete statues and things like that that are all still there, actually. A thing called Smoke Signals and in Lincoln and some other things around town and all of that. So he came out to Hollywood after a while, thinking that, well, maybe they could use his, you know, his talents, and maybe he could break into the industry or whatnot. So he came to Hollywood and started making props and things for the prop rental companies, skulls and cactus and lizards and cakes and fish and all that kind of stuff that, you know, all the old movies really needed all of that stuff available, you know. Oh, you need a ton of fish? Well, yeah, we can give you a ton of fish, you know. So my grandfather would be working on those kinds of things, and they called him to ask him to do to sculpt a cane a wolf's head cane for the Wolfman.
Amazing.
1941. So on that, he met Jack Pierce, who said, wow, you know, you do all this great sculpting and molding and casting and all of that stuff. I just build up right on their faces and all that. Maybe you could make stuff for me as long as you don't tell anybody. So all the sequels and all of that stuff, and where they started using like rubber masks and all that kind of stuff for all of the horror films, it's probably my grandfather's work, you know, doing it, behind the scenes. So then he got a job working at Don Post Studio and helped teach them how to do production mask making, so they could make more than one or two masks a day out of each mold. They could, you know, produce a lot more stuff. And they called him in to sculpt a giant gorilla, you know. And so so my dad got to assist him. My grandfather called him over and said, hey, help me do this. And so they started making this giant gorilla. And while he was there, my dad heard about an apprenticeship program opening up at 20th Century Fox. And so he, along with another almost 100 applicants, all applied for a makeup apprenticeship at the Fox Studios. And three people got picked, and my dad was one of them. And because my dad had experience making molds and doing all that stuff, helping my grandfather as a child, they picked him because he was experienced. Within 6 months, the big film came in, and they're like, oh, we got to do this big giant film. We need all these people, all this stuff like that. And, you know, get this guy, get that guy. And my dad said, well, John Chambers really did all that work. And they all call him. And So they brought in John Chambers to Fox, and they started Planet of the Apes. And so that pretty much changed everything. My father did, you know, the Planet of the Apes and Beneath the Planet of the Apes while an apprentice at 20th Century Fox. He and John started their own effects studio or makeup studio after that, because what John didn't tell anybody was that they had a contract with the CIA to do disguise stuff. They couldn't do it under the watchful eye of the studios, so they left the lot. And everybody told them they were crazy, you're never going to survive, but they didn't tell everybody that they had this contract.
Wow.
So they started their own studio and all that. After a few years, they bought my dad and my uncle bought out John, and then eventually my dad bought out my uncle, and it just became the Berman Studio. And then they did all that. They did all the 70s stuff. My first time anybody had put servos in a monster suit, you know, first time anybody had done this, first time anybody had ever done that. They were the guys that did all of that. They had Dick Smith on the East Coast. They had Tom Berman on the West Coast. And, then I got out of high school, or got into high school, thinking all my friends were making money, you know, as busboys and working in the markets and things like that. And I'm like, well, I want money too, you know? And so, I started cleaning. I started as a janitor at this nighttime cleaning company, and that lasted a couple of months. And then I became a dishwasher at an ice cream parlor. That lasted a couple of months. And finally said, you know, hey, Dad, your shop is really messy all the time. How about my friend Dale and I come in a few nights a week and clean it up for you? And then you can come into a clean shop the next day. They thought that was great. So we did that. And then all of a sudden, I'd be in class the next day because I was still in high school. And they'd a person from the office would come with a note and say, hey, you're wanted in the office. And I'd have to go up to the office and, what is it? There's a phone call for you. It's your father, you know. And so I would pick up the phone. What do you want? And he'd say, well, where'd you put this? Where'd you put that? I need this thing. And I'd say, well, I put this there. I put that there. I never saw this. Don't know what it is. And then he'd say, come in after school. And, well, I was going to go do it. No, come in after school. Okay, so I would come in after school. And then through my senior year, I was there pretty much what you would call full part-time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I graduated, I just stayed, and we were doing shows like The Beast Within and Cat People and those things for that year. And then when he laid me off, he recommended me for a job where they needed a foam runner, and it turned out to be the thing for Rob Bottin. And
wow.
I'm like, okay, well, I guess this is what I'm going to do.
Well, now, for people who maybe aren't as familiar, you referenced the servo motor. I might get you to tell a little bit about more detail about that and where that came into play, because that is an important innovation in makeup effects. And so I'll get you to tell a little bit more about that if you don't mind.
No problem. My uncle Ellis Berman Jr., mm-hmm. who we refer to as Sonny in the family, he was a mechanical genius. He could machine anything that was really amazing. In fact, without my uncle, the Terminator would not exist the way it does now. There's some sculpted parts on the Terminator, some chest plates and the sculpted skull and all of that. But 90% of that thing is hand machined metal done on a lathe and on machines by my uncle. You know, the arm that worked and the foot and the legs, all of that stuff was all built by my uncle. So, you know, when you talk about things like servos, little things that'll move a little, you know, move a little lever. Well, you put that inside of a rubber head and connect it to a fiberglass skull. When that thing moves, all of a sudden your rubber head goes,
yeah,
you know, and it moves, or the brows go up and down, or, you know, you put enough servos in there and all of a sudden that head just kind of comes to life, you know, if it's puppeteered properly.
Yeah, and the first film they used that on, what was that again? It was
The Prophecy.
The John Frankenheimer. Bit, yes, that know. Is correct. That's some great work in that film. And you know, it was a critically maligned film. It sits proudly on the shelf behind me on Blu-ray. In fact, there's quite a few of your films sitting back there. I think the effects in that film were really underrated and were pretty innovative at the time. I remember seeing it. You know, I was probably in my early teens when I saw it, and really, really impressed me. And still to this day, I watched the Blu-ray when it came out a couple of years ago, revisited it, and it still holds up. I thought, you know, I'd rather see this any day in place.
It's got the ecological warning.
Yes.
It's got all that and things. And it's got those cool mutant babies. That's probably the best part of the whole movie, the little baby bears.
I talked to David Seltzer, who wrote it. Actually, I talked to him several years ago, and he had a little insight on, you know, how that came to be and how it changed a little bit, you know, after he wrote it, as it does, you know. But
it always does.
It normally does. But, yeah, I thought, you know, he was coming a couple of years off The Omen, I think at that point, and that was
right.
He doesn't like to he told me that he doesn't like to sequelize, so he was on to the next project, so
something completely different.
Yeah, right. So anyway,
I think what's in that movie that people don't realize effects wise anyway, because everybody mentions, you know, the kid in the sleeping bag who gets smashed against a tree, you know, all of these things, the guys who get pulled over the cliff in the beginning, and there's all that stuff like that. But what they don't really realize is that in shooting that, they had a company, Jack Shafton's costume company, make a literal 15-foot bear. It was 15 feet tall. It was huge. Only used for wide shots and all of that. The rest of the stuff was all my dad's 6-foot bear.
With
little people as the stuntmen.
Yeah.
And half-sized dummies. Things like that, so that scale-wise, that thing looked much bigger, you know, than what it really was.
Yeah,
so I think, and that's something that nobody really kind of has ever talked to me about or mentioned and things. And I'm thinking that's the brilliance in that film is the you know, shooting those scale things. You know, by the time they got to the Lord of the Rings, they pretty much had it down pat.
Yeah,
but, you know, back then they were switching back and forth in scales, and that wasn't done very often.
No, it wasn't. You're right. And like I said, Prophecy. I think Frankenheimer did a good job in terms of like the coverage of the creatures, as it were, I guess you would say. And so you know, like I said, it took a drubbing critically, but I never quite saw it. I thought, you know, there's some good stuff here. I don't know.
It's not a great film.
No, it's not.
It's a fun thing. You know, it's a romp.
But, anyway, so well, you were saying that, you know, you came onto the scene in 82, which was an extremely busy year, or I should say 81, because they were probably ramping up for these films you talked about, Cat People and The Beast Within.
The first films that I worked on at my dad's shop were Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Oh, well, that's a guilty
Peter
pleasure.
Frampton and the Bee Gees.
Yeah. What did
I was
you do?
Trimming parts and things like that for some dummies they made. They made the old men as the band.
Yes.
Display in the museum.
Sure.
So, but then we did Happy Birthday to Me and My Bloody Valentine over one summer when they were having actors strikes here and everything. And these were Canadian films. So we got to do all this cool stuff. And so those are the first two, probably. We did those simultaneously.
Yeah. That's I know all of that was horror was a big thing in the early 80s. Of course, I was a subscriber to Fangoria magazine, Fangoria, I would read those articles in my early teens. And that was really the only way you could get this behind-the-scenes information. You know, there wasn't
pretty much
all of these. And they would do some really good articles about some of the work that was going on with the Berman Studios. And so that was my first exposure to what was happening. And I remember when I was in sixth grade, The Beast Within came out. And, you know, again, a flawed film. But I have always said, and I will die on this hill, as the saying goes, but I still say that it is the best transformation sequence in any film. It completely is is amazing to this day.
I think it bookends. I think you've got the Beast Within at one end, and then you've got American Werewolf in the middle.
Yes.
And then you've got Cat People at the other end,
mm-hmm.
where the Beast Within is like, let's see how far these bladders will go. You know, and then you've got American Werewolf, where it's like, look at my hand stretch. Oh! And then you've got Cat People, where things go bang and happen in a heartbeat. And it's like, wow, what the hell was that? You know?
So. Yeah, that's it's like I said, it's just amazing. And of course, as my kids got older, I ran the movie for them, and they're very familiar with it as well. So it moves on to the next generation, as it were.
Sure.
And so, yeah, again, sits proudly right behind me there. But
it's got my favorite worst movie my favorite worst movie line of all time. And it's R.G. Armstrong. He comes out of the hospital room where the transformation is going on. He looks at the two leads and he goes, something terrible is going on in there. Or no, something terrible is happening in there. Just this flat, bad line. And I'm like, the guy's turning into a damn bug, for Christ's sake. Something terrible is happening? Yeah, I guess so.
Now you went on to work with that director again on Howling 2, I believe.
I didn't work with him directly on either one of those.
Okay, okay.
Thank goodness. You know, I was, for my dad, I was just the low man shop rat.
Yeah.
And for my uncle on the Howling 2 was, I did all this prep work and everything. And then when they went to Czechoslovakia to shoot, mm-hmm. I didn't get to go.
Oh, bummer.
But if I'd gone, I wouldn't have come over to my dad's and done Teen Wolf and the Goonies. So I think it was a fair trade.
Yeah, I would
not
say
the
so.
Howling 2 and Teen Wolf and Goonies. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think they're more fondly remembered, I would say, if you're talking about films made in that time frame. Yeah. But
if you're talking about boobs, you got to go with Howling 2.
True, Sybil Danning. I mean, come on. But absolutely. Yeah, well, I will say, I do, before we move on, want to ask you about this. Now, I've heard, and I guess you can confirm this, that, you know, Paul Schrader obviously directed Cat People, and he's not known as a horror film director. And so there's always been a lot of talk about things that you guys created that weren't in the film, the final film of Cat People. Maybe that's just hearsay. You know, I've been hearing that for years, but I heard that there was a more elaborate transformation that was planned that he just really chose not to use for whatever reasons, artistic or whatever, in the end. And I was just curious about that.
Not true.
Okay.
Everything we made is on film.
Okay, great, great. Well, that's good
because
to dispel that.
The whole idea was this. My father wanted to do something. He didn't want to do the long, slow, bone-crunching agony mm-hmm. and, like I said, watch my hand grow, you know. He didn't want to do that. He wanted something that was started out almost playful. I mean, she's swatting at the fly, and she's starting, all of a sudden it's starting to go, and it's surprising her, and it happens, and it's sleek, and it's fast, and it's sexy, you know. Mm-hmm. And that whole sequence where it looks like they jump cut and went, oh, they must have missed something. That was an intentional jump cut. Because as the skin splits open, there's a cat head coming from the inside. And that cat head becomes the panther that they cut to. That's the live one moving around like that. So mm-hmm. it's a way to make it more sleek and stylized and take it away from the bone crunching agony. My dad storyboarded all those sequences and took them to Paul Schrader and said, this is what I want to do. And Paul went, that looks great. And that's what they did.
Oh, very good. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these things get started, and I don't know where they get started, but I thought, you know what? It's better to go to the horse's mouth and find out for sure.
Right,
so.
Right. Even the arm tearing off sequence, all of that is, you know, exactly the way we set up to do it.
Yeah, I revisit.
In fact, that's my arm in that sequence. We couldn't get Ed Begley Jr. in time.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So, yeah. Now, were you, obviously you weren't doing this at the time, but you, I'm sure you were probably around or in some degree or capacity when your father was working on Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The film.
You know, most of that was done out of suitcases. They would slam the workout during the week or on the weekends. And then pack everything up and Sunday night fly up to San Francisco and shoot for the week and then come back. There wasn't a whole lot of prep. And the prep work, since I was at that time, I was probably like 13, 14. I would have been like, I don't want to have to go to dad's shop. I don't want to, you know, I can remember seeing some stuff. I remember going over there when they did Prophecy and seeing the bear head sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really remember going over during Body Snatchers much at all.
Yeah,
I remember Prophecy for the most part. And then my dad would bring me over. My mom would bring us over if there was like some really important person having their life cast done. You know, we got to come over when Robin Williams was there. We got to come over when Ringo Starr came in. You know, anything that they went... The kids should see this. The kids should meet these people. They would bring us.
Good for them. Because, yeah, those are memories that you'll take with you for a lifetime.
Sure.
Absolutely. So,
listening to my brother regurgitating George Carlin jokes to Robin Williams and having him fire back like this was brilliant. I mean, you know, that doesn't happen in your lifetime.
So. Yeah, those are pinch me moments for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, well, okay, I think we've covered some of these questions. I had a few things I jotted down, but I think you've already answered the first two. So, but we'll move along, though. So you were moving into doing your own thing on John Carpenter's The Thing. I guess we can talk about that a little bit, working with Rob Bottin, since he doesn't like to do press at all or interviews or anything. He's very kind of guarded with all that stuff and these days. And so you're probably the closest we can get to finding out what happened there.
I'm one of the few people that's willing to talk about it because I'm not afraid of Rob. Most of the people that were on that show were some of his best friends to bring in, you know, Margaret Becerra and all of that. So you know, they're very loyal to him, and I understand it. I'm not not loyal to him. It's just you know, I'm willing to talk about the work that I did. You know.
Yeah. Well, talk about it. How long were you involved? What was the time that you spent actually, you know?
I was on the job for about 5 months.
Oh, okay.
Just running foam latex. That was my department with my best friend, Dale Brady. And they would just bring us all their molds, and we would find ways of doing it. When we get brought in... basically, it was the job that nobody wanted to do, but it needed to be done and things. So people, when they had downtime, would do it. But then they were getting terrible results because, you know, people weren't really trained to work it properly, and they were just doing because, oh, yeah, I ran foam when I was back in school. I can do that. And then, you know, things never coming out properly and all of that stuff. So they decided they really needed to get that department as a department. So Dale and I came in and we did, you know, they says, oh, are you used to doing big batches of foam latex? I'm thinking, oh yeah, sure. We've done some big batches. We've done the full bowl, you know, and a quarter, half and a full bowl, no problem like that. We walked into the foam room and there were 3 20 quart Hobart mixers. And it was like, oh, big batches of foam. Nobody I knew had done anything like that prior to that. Nobody I knew and nobody in the industry at that time probably had the experience of doing anything like that. So we faked it, you know. But because we were faking it every single day, we got to see exactly what the results were and kind of alter everything until everything was right. And Rob came from that school with Rick Baker and Dick Smith, where everything has to be absolutely perfect, the tiniest little bubble, and it wasn't good enough for them. So, you know, and then they wanted to have as many backups as we get. At one time, we had 30 backups of perfect heads for the Norris head that crawls across the floor.
Right, yeah. You know? Wow. Amazing. Yeah, that's...
And then we came in after the weekend, they were all torn.
Oh, gosh.
The mechanical guys would use them to test, and when it tore, they'd just go get another one.
Oh, gosh. Well, when you're figuring it out as you go along, I guess things like that are bound to happen, unfortunately. But
pretty much, yeah.
But it was certainly
long hours of just keep doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine. It was certainly a game changer. And you know, 42 years on, we're still talking about it, which I don't know that you anticipated.
Still
that.
Still the greatest practical effects film to date.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
Something without any CGI in it and everything. If you want to take the sequence from the moment Charles Hallahan starts to have his heart attack until they toast the spider head crawling out of the room, that whole sequence in between, for me, is the greatest scene of my career. Probably the greatest effects scene ever done for film. And nothing like it has even been close to coming to that, especially even in the age of CGI. Just isn't.
Yeah, and you can go and see the 2011 The Thing prequel, I guess you would call it. You know, as sure. If you want to compare and see how it's done properly and how it's not done properly, just watch those two films.
Well, you can see in the 1980s, in the original thing, that the limitations we had when you put it up next to the CGI film.
Yeah.
But the CGI film looks like a big cartoon.
It does. And the lack of tangibility, there's, you know, the actor, when the actors are actually working with something that's tangible, you can tell to me. It's very palpable. And I can see it. I can feel, even though I'm obviously not there, but it comes across as a viewer.
I've been watching action films from the 80s lately, particularly the Blues Brothers film.
Love it.
And I've been watching it. When you see a car crash, you feel it. It's just bang. It's hardcore. You know that there was metal and all that stuff. And now when you watch a car crash, with Deadpool as the exception, because I really liked Deadpool. But everything is a slow motion ballet.
Yes. It's true.
That's every car crash in the last 10 years. You know? So boring. So, you know, okay, next. Move on. Get out of it. We know they had a car crash. Okay, great.
Yeah, this whole thing that started with The Matrix and Bullet Time, where
is great in its place and it looks cool.
Yeah,
but not always.
Yeah, it was innovative at the time, but it has definitely become a cliche at this point.
Absolutely.
I would definitely agree. So, so we'll move along to some other topics here, and I had a list of your credits, just so I was, and some of these maybe, you know.
Any good ones?
Well, there's some interesting ones, like Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone. I mean, you know, not known critically as a film that people are talking about, but, you know, it was a 3D film. And
it was so much fun. I loved it. I was 19 years old, and I was it was the first time my dad gave me charge of the shop, and I my first location job going up to Vancouver, and I was king of the world. So I was disappointed that it wasn't a better film.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great film, but, you know, it's interesting. And I was wondering if the 3D wouldn't really change anything about your particular job that you were assigned. The fact that it was being shot in 3D probably didn't have any bearing on you is what I'm getting
at. It tripled the budget of the movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, I could imagine that. Yeah. Yeah,
we went from $4 million to $12 million. Not that we got any more of it. But, you know.
I am fortunate that I do have a setup in my home where I can see these films in 3D. And so I do, awesome. I'm able to, and a lot of these films that were made around that time, without that 3D, they're just not as much fun. But when you are fortunate enough to have be able to see them in 3D as I am, they are fun in their own way.
They can be, yes.
Yes, like Jaws 3D, I went back and rewatched that last summer. And again, not a great film by any stretch of the imagination, but some of those 3D effects are just so interesting, and you can tell they were really trying hard, and it's like, you know, this is, it's goofy, but it's fun. You
They're
know,
cramming it down your throat with a hypodermic needle going in like
yes, exactly, exactly.
It's like, oh my God.
Yeah, and it's not that post-converted 3D like you would get in the 2010s. You know, when they would shoot right. something flat and then go post-convert it. So that, you know, it's different too. So, but yeah, we'll, let's see, what else do we have here? 52 Pickup was listed on your resume. I don't know how involved in that you were, but that's another film that I am a fan of as well.
I made the John Glover body that gets blown up in the car in the end.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely impressive. I like that
Just
film.
Made a thing of him like this.
Yeah,
and blew it the hell up.
Yeah, that's it's probably the only film you're ever going to see where Ann Margaret's addicted to heroin, you know. So
of course, yeah. And I was working for Canon Films at that time. We did 15 films in 11 months.
Amazing.
Just cramming them out one right after the other.
That's a heck of a pace. It really is. Yeah, it's and John Frankenheimer directing that too. So call back to our earlier discussion on Prophecy.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's amazing that Canon got some of the directors that they got. I was surprised.
Oh yeah.
They're really good directors sometimes.
So recently we lost Jeff Burr, the director, and he did From a Whisper to a Scream, which is a film that turned up on cable for me quite a bit. I saw it many times when I was in high school and quite enjoyed it. And I was friendly with Jeff and was really saddened about his passing, untimely,
right.
Of course. And so this was some good talent in this film. Vincent Price and Clu Gulager. Yeah. And,
well, the Vincent Price thing is funny because he turned him down all the way until the movie was finished. And then his wife said, oh, help the kids out. So... I like From Whisper to a Scream because I kind of had carte blanche to just, mm-hmm. I was sort of big man on campus. I was the experienced guy on the crew, you know, me and the DP and things like that. We'd had careers and things like that somewhat, but this was my first opportunity to do, you know, kind of my big effects show and all of that for no budget. And so I did everything I could. A few things didn't work the way I wanted them to. They didn't do what they should. Mutant baby in it. We got on set and got it all ready and started to move it. All the cables just snapped.
Oh, man.
So there were some horror stories there, but most of the stuff worked out pretty well. And, you know, my brother got a cameo. And so, you know, it was all fun.
Good. Yeah, I was wondering about that because, like I said, again, it's one that I grew up with and I have a fondness for.
It's not a bad little anthology film.
No,
for no money.
Exactly.
It looks like it belonged on like late night Friday night.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was around that era where they were doing Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side, Tales from the Crypt, and those sorts of things. So, yeah, the anthology film was kind of had its place around that time, and I still enjoy anthology films. Loved the Amicus films from the 60s and 70s. Big fan of those. So, yeah, I kind of was raised on those, as it were. But, a couple other things here. Let's see. So it said, you know, of course, IMDb cannot always be believed, but it says that you were uncredited as a mold maker on Batman Returns. I was wondering if there's any truth to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I spent almost 5 months on that job, 4 months, I think. I got brought in to do molds on all of the... Danny DeVito body parts and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And because he had a complete suit of parts that he was wearing. They were going to originally do a nude scene. So had very detailed body stuff inside that distorted him and all of that. So I made all the molds for those and cast all the parts for them that ended up just being underneath layers of costume. Except for the union suit scene, they did keep that. And then once I got finished making all those molds, they moved me over, because I had experience doing foam latex. They moved me into seaming and patching of bat and cat suits. So we would make, they would give me a bat cowl that had seams on it, and I had to make it look pristine and perfect, you know, and give me any parts that had bubbles or improper things here and there. And so I just spent about almost 3 months just patching and doing that, gluing appliques onto the Catwoman costume, because you couldn't really cut her costume, or it would cause a run that would just keep going and you couldn't stop
it. Sure, yeah.
So all of her splits and tears and all that stuff that looks like it was stitched together are prosthetic appliques.
Oh, you never.
They had a little backing that looked like skin, and then the front looked like black, and you'd glue it onto here, and you'd put stitching into it and all of that, and it looked like her suit was coming apart.
And
three
she
different
wore...
stages of cowls, so that it got more and more and more falling apart.
Oh, yeah.
But they all had to be sculpted individually, and I would go in, and every single little stitch in each cowl would come out of the mold in foam latex with a bubble in it. So I had to cut all the stitches off and redraw them in with a little syringe and some latex, and hand do every 236 stitches in each cowl.
Wow, that is really a testament to how difficult things could be in the days before CGI and all that, you know, because...
Well, it's why our budget went from $3 million for the costumes for the three characters to five.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they spent that much money, and you had a big team. There was, you know, 10 big time union mold makers in that shop at any given time. And, you know, that's expensive. That's a lot of money.
That's definitely daunting to think about that.
Yeah, you're talking probably that shop probably cost the Warner Brothers $100,000 an hour.
Jeez. Wow. And yet Michelle Pfeiffer wears the suit quite well, I must say. So.
Oh, the worst weight took her 45 minutes to get in it every day, but, you know.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention that. So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, she's still the ultimate Catwoman now.
Oh, yeah.
She displaced Lee Merriweather and everybody from the original series. So, you know.
Yeah, I don't know that she can be topped in that role.
It was going to be Annette Bening.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot all about that. Yeah.
Halfway through production, they came in and said, we're changing it. And so all our designs had to go from Annette Bening to Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah. And I know Sean Young was lobbying for that role, but I don't think they wanted her.
I don't think she was ever even close.
But yeah, Annette Bening, I'd forgotten about that. I'm glad you reminded me of that, because yeah, I knew about that at the time, and it's one of those factoids that just kind of left me all.
I don't think Catwoman would have looked good pregnant, I'll tell you.
No, that would have definitely made things. You'd have been having to stitch a completely different suit together, I think.
That's right. That's right. It's a whole different fetish.
Yeah. So I find it ironic that 15 years after the release of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you're credited with working on the Abel Ferrara remake of called Body Snatchers, which Roger Ebert famously gave 4 stars to, from what I recall. He loved that film.
Yeah, I don't know why. Abel did not want to do a sci-fi film.
Mm-hmm.
He liked the moody thriller, but he didn't want to do sci-fi. And he was contractually obligated to deliver a sci-fi film. So he fought us tooth and nail every step of the way, to the point to where we would show up on set and everything, because, you know, we only had so much time, would be shot would be built to shoot this way. And he'd go, nah, I don't want to do that. I want to do it this way. We're like, well, but we can't shoot it from that way. There's no other. And he'd go, but that's what I want to do. So, you know, it was, he really did fight. I don't like the pods. I don't want to use the pods. What do you mean you don't want to use the pods? You know? No, I just thought they don't scare me.
Well, this is a Body Snatchers film. You know, the pods are kind of integral to the plot. So it's.
He came in and did this whole dissertation about when the pod was going to take over Gabrielle Anwar in the bathtub and all that stuff. And he's in there and he's like, okay. Okay, so the expletive is in the expletive, and she's in the expletive, 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 expletive. And you know, and then the thing comes down, and it's going all over expletives. And it's like, wait a minute. Only because I don't want to say the words.
Sure, sure, sure.
But it was just like, oh my God, he just is just nuts about this whole moment.
Uh-huh.
Which has got, you know, it's going to last a minute in the film, but, you know. Seemed like that was what the whole movie was about for him. So, I don't know. And then he didn't want to see the pod, so.
Everybody has their own predilections, I guess. Yeah. So I think your next film was Super Mario Brothers, I believe. And, of course, that has gotten somewhat of a resurgence in popularity due to the popularity of the reboot or whatever.
Yeah,
last year.
Another one I don't understand. It's awful, unless you were a kid at the time.
Yeah, it's...
My work is 13 seconds in the end. We kill King Koopa, and half of it is all CGI, but our work is actually on screen for 13 seconds. So 13 weeks of work for 13 seconds of film.
Well, I have to admit, I was a little bit, I was in my mid-20s by the time this came out, so it wasn't really the kind of film that I was seeking out. I was seeking out more serious-minded fare, I guess you would say. So I kind of skipped it, and I haven't seen it, so I can't really testify to the quality.
Well, you can watch The Last End Transformation, and then you got it. Then,
maybe
I'll say everybody working on the film that I worked with, not for, but... You know, Makeup Effects Labs was on that job, and some other guys did some other things. All that, everybody brought their A game and did some great work.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the day I arrived on set, the directors quit, and I still had 3 weeks of shooting to do. So, you know, that gives you an idea how troubled the production was.
Yeah, pretty bad.
And you know, so they went off and did whatever. And I think Dean Semler saved the film, pretty much directing the end sequences for the rest of us. And, you know.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I know it was a troubled production. And I know there was an alternate cut that has only survived in a VHS work print, I think. And that recently got issued on a Blu-ray from this Australian label called Umbrella Entertainment. So it has just been put out on a bonus disc. Like I said, the quality I hear is negligible, but at least you can see it, you know. So
yeah.
For anybody who wants to see a different cut of the film. So we'll move along to Mighty Morphin Power Rangers is another film that I was a little bit too old to. It really wasn't my kind of thing, but I know, again, there are a lot of fans of this.
Oh yeah, I still get today people trying to get me to make costumes for them from that. That was the first show that my wife and I did together as costume designer, mm-hmm. and makeup effects guy. It was the first year we started our company. It was the year we got married. We did a lot in that year. But,
yeah, I would say so.
But that job was probably the hardest job we've still had to date, because you know, making somebody look like a Ferrari is hard.
Yeah.
Clean lines, perfect everything. If anything's off, it sticks out, it shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we were hobbled by having to use some materials that we didn't buy, but the costume department did. And we got married to that, to where we had to use that material, and it just wasn't the right material.
Yeah.
So it was very hard, and 20 weeks or something like that of forcing something to work.
Yeah.
And it did.
It's, you know, you never can tell. Sometimes under duress, you get the best results. You never can tell. So,
well, we couldn't let up. We had to just be, you know, if we let up ever at all, then mm-hmm. it showed. And so we couldn't do that.
Yeah.
You know.
Push ahead, as they say. Yep.
Sure.
So, well, we'll move into the 2000s, and Donnie Darko, you're listed as uncredited.
I was waiting for this one.
Yep. So, I had to mention it. Yeah, because there are, again, a lot of fans of this one, so I had to couldn't skip it.
I have to say that as I was doing it, because I did it for my friend Dale Brady, who I worked with on The Thing and Ghostbusters and all of that. He came to me wanting me to sculpt the thing and showed me a sketch on a napkin that kind of looked like Bugs Bunny's skull on LSD. And I thought, huh, well, okay. And this is what they really want. Yeah, this is what they want. Okay. So I sculpted it. Did they like it? Yeah, they like it. Well, okay. And then he took it from me and they asked him to make the teeth a little goofier and the eyes a little different. But otherwise, it's my sculpture. It's the silliest thing I've ever been asked to sculpt.
And you've worked a lot, so that's something.
I just kept thinking, oh my God. And then I'd ask, I go, so what's the costume going to look like? Well, it's going to be a big fur bunny suit. Wait, what? It's going to be a big fur bunny suit, like from the costume shop? Yeah, from the costume. Okay. Whatever they want to do. That's great. I'm washing my hands of this one. In fact, I never even took pictures of the sculpture when I was finished. Mm-hmm. So, that's how much faith I had in it. And well, sorry, it apparently is a cult favorite. And oops.
People love it. I'm telling you, it's amazing how it just keeps going and going. Like that bunny, it keeps going and going and going. So
Energizer bunny.
That's right. So, yeah. So we'll move into a couple other titles now. Jackass, the movie, you're listed as that they had a 16mm film unit, and you did some makeup work on that as well.
I was brought in by Tony Gardner's crew for just a couple of days, mm-hmm. one day in the shop, and then one day I helped James Rowland make up Ryan Dunn. He came in. He came in very late because he did not wake up, and the hotel security had to come and remove his door so that they could wake him up and get him onto set. And he climbed in there pretty hungover and dead. But by the time we got the makeup done, he was pretty into it. And they were some just crazy people to work with. They just do all kinds of nutty things. Even when the camera's not on them, they just still do. They're just like that always. And I thought, I'm glad I'm only on this show for a day or two.
Yeah, that a little bit of that would probably be okay, but all the time, I don't know.
Yeah, it was novel for the day.
Yeah, for a day. Yep. So, well, we'll move into the late 2000s, and you were involved in Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams reboot. And
yeah, that was my brother's job. He had done the Tom Cruise makeup in Tropic Thunder.
Yes.
And so JJ really liked him and said, okay, well, I've got this, Star Trek. I'd like to do that. Because JJ didn't want to get people that were like your typical Star Trek canon. This.
Yeah.
Fresh and new. Mm-hmm. So he brought my brother in.
I think we may have frozen up here.
Herman, thank goodness. My friend Russell was that, and that was good. So we just kept doing one thing right after another until they'd either get used or not. And they made two makeup factions. They moved all of the Vulcaneers over onto the lot because they were just having to produce so many ears that we didn't really have time to move them between shops and stuff. We just moved onto the lot and produced them there. And You know, I stayed in the shop out in Pacoima and just molded things like crazy. That was good fun. I actually campaigned for my brother to do that because I was teaching at the time and doing that. And when I found out he was going to get the job, I'm like, I want to be on that. I want to be there for that.
Yeah.
And then he got an Oscar. So, you know, he was determined when he first set out. He said, "This, if I don't get an Oscar for this, it's going to not be from a lack of trying." And, you know, so we all put forth the effort that we needed to put into to do that. And I realized that that's not something I'm going to put that much effort into anymore. I always said, oh, yeah, I would love to learn an Oscar. And now what I know what it takes to actually do it, I'm like, yeah, I don't need that bad.
Well, yeah, you reach a point, that's for sure, I can imagine. Yeah, well, a couple other films.
I've decided that if anything isn't fun anymore, I'm not doing it. So.
Yeah, I can understand that. I'm kind of in the same boat. I'm the same way. Yep. So I have. There were times when I said yes to everything, and it's like you get to a point where it's like, no, if it's not something I'm really interested in, I don't. It's okay to say no. So it's a lesson to learn.
Absolutely.
We get older. Yes. Well, there were a couple other films that I know we touched on Terminator a while ago, earlier in the conversation, but Terminator 2 Judgment Day, you were involved with that a little bit, I think.
I came in for a week because they had some foam problems, and I kind of solved their problems and moved on.
Okay.
But I got a credit. You know, it's one I can save for Batman or Ghostbusters, you know.
Yeah, you can't... Yeah, and we skipped over Ghostbusters right quick. I guess we do need to talk about that one, so you can tell what you did on that as well. So I'm sorry.
If it was the same thing as The Thing, if it was made of foam latex, it came by mine and Dale's department. We just ran everything in that. We were doing really big amounts of foam. That's more foam than anybody had done up until that point to do, like, the Terror Dogs and whatnot. And, you know, that was another 5-month job that was just, as I was working on it, I knew it was going to be good. You know, I'd read the script over a Thanksgiving break and thought, that's actually really funny. I'd never read a script that I actually thought was funny before. You know, I thought if they can do that script, this could be good.
Yeah.
You know, and then as things started coming back and saw what we were doing and, you know, it was like, yeah, this is really working. And we got to see some test footage of Slimer in action, and he was flailing all about. And the head of Boss Films, Richard Edlin, you know, turned and looked at me, and he's like, so what'd you think? Almost. He says, what do you mean, almost? And I'm like, well, he doesn't do anything. He does this. He doesn't... do anything, you know? He's not, doesn't have an activity of something. So then they put in the whole things where he's going through the room service cart and when they're popping out of the hot dog cart and things like that, to where he had gags rather than just being a flailing ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I feel like I contributed pretty well to that in that moment.
Oh yeah, sure sounds like it. Yeah, and of course they're, again, still making them.
Yeah, sure. And they still will.
Yeah.
None of them have really gotten captured what the first one did. But
no.
I think the last one, the Afterlife one, wasn't too bad. It was fun. It was more like watching Stranger Things or, you know, Super 8, one of those movies, you know. But it was all right.
Yeah, that's it definitely it's a franchise that definitely has legs, as they say.
Yes.
Well, I guess one more title would be Tremors, and I know you did some supposedly did some creature effects for that as well. That's another one that people talk about, so I guess we should mention it.
Well, yeah, and again, most of my career when people would bring me in is because they had foam latex problems or didn't know what to do, and they had to make a giant worm in foam latex, and they needed somebody who knew how to do big, giant batches of foam, so... they called me. I came in for about 2 weeks. I cast 2 giant worm heads and about a half a dozen tentacles, you know, in that time. Those worm heads, and it's, you know, unless you're the technician, you're not really going to, probably not going to appreciate it the way it is. But I'll say Your average batch of foam latex is about this big. You know, it's about a quart size of material. To do a 20-quart mixer, you know, you're 20 times that.
Yeah.
Well, the giant worm took 14 of those mixers to fill. So it was huge. It was like making a giant volcano in the middle of the room. It was 6 feet tall and almost 8 feet in diameter. It was a giant fiberglass mold in the middle of the room, and we'd fill up the bottom and then move up and fill up the next and clean up and fill up the next all the way to the top and finally get it all done. It would take all day to do that, and then it took another day and a half to cook the foam. So, you know, slow process and lots of material, and that's why we only did two.
Yeah.
Both came out perfect, by the way. So, you know, we didn't need any more.
Yeah, the end result is quite impressive, obviously. And I rewatched.
Yeah, well, that's why they called me.
Yeah. You know what you're doing. That's for sure. And the results are there on screen for all to see from now on.
It's one of the better. It's another one of those films that I worked on along with Ghostbusters or T2 or those where I can just pick it up at any point in the film and watch it for the rest of the, you know, if I get caught, I just get sucked right in and I enjoy the movie, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with me or any of my memories. It's like, this is a good movie.
Yeah. You can divorce yourself from the actual work on the project and just enjoy it for what it is. Yeah. And we kind of glossed over Goonies as well. That's something else because we touched base on that. I guess we should cover that one too.
Right. Doing Goonies and Teen. We were doing Teen Wolf, and we were about halfway into that show, and we got called by Richard Donner to do a giant octopus.
Mm-hmm.
My dad's like, "Can we do it? They needed it in 8 weeks. Can we do it?" And I'm like, "No problem." They used to call me "No Problem Rob," so I would just, "Hey, no problem. Everything was fine." That's from my days of yes to everything, you know. So we do that, and so we got the job. We built our 32-foot octopus, and you know, it was good fun to build. They said, "Well, we'll move it. You don't need to move it. We'll just, you know." So we did all the skin for it and the cosmetics and gave it to them. And in the middle of doing that, they called us and said, "We're having problems with one of the makeups on the show. We can't get, you know, we're having troubles with the artist who's doing it and missing deadlines and things like that. And it's not looking right. And Steven's really upset. And so can you do this?" So we did the sloth makeup in like 8 days.
Oh, that's amazing.
Slammed that thing out. Made a couple of changes after that, but nothing major. My uncle did all the mechanical eye stuff and the mechanical ear wiggling and that kind of and whatnot. And we slammed it out in about 8 days and pulled it off. And now he's one of the most memorable characters in film.
Oh, yeah. There's no questioning that because if you were of a certain
age,
they
cut the octopus because it looked like this. It looked terrible.
that kind of reminds you of the scene in the film Ed Wood where they get the octopus and they can't. There's no motor in it and they have to pretend that it's.
That's why they cut it. Because the grip department had told them, "Oh no, we can make it move." And they thought, "We'll just marionette it."
Yes. Yeah.
You know? And so it did this. And it's like, well, wait. That's not moving. That's not the way an octopus moves. And, you know, thank goodness they cut it. You can see the whole most of the sequence in the Cyndi Lauper Goonies Are Good Enough video.
Yes.
So at least I got to see what it looked like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably a wise choice that they decided to go the way they did without. Yeah. Well,
absolutely.
Well, I'm not going to take up too much of your time. This has been so much fun. I will say that I so enjoy your comments to some of my posts on Facebook because I have this thing that I do every day, as you're well aware, and a lot of other people are, that I try to remember somebody who passed on this day and remember their work. And a lot of times you will chime in with a personal remembrance of these people because you worked with them. And some of them are really interesting tidbits of information, and one of the ones that I keep it's a story that I just keep repeating. It's one that you mentioned was when you were working on the Hudsucker proxy, and I said I had did the remembrance on Charles Durning, and you said when you did his measurements, his circumference and his height was exactly the same. And I have gotten so much mileage out of that story.
My wife was built the flying harnesses for him so that he could be in the yes. Angel mm-hmm. flying, and then she made the wings as well.
Yeah.
So she would come back home at the end of the day and go, "Well, I met Charles Durning today," and be like, "Oh, well, he's just as big this way as he is this way."
He was one of the greats, but yes, he was. But that was so funny. I laughed so hard when you chimed in with that. And so I always tell people, I say, I don't do this to be morbid because I'm trying to remember their work. But occasionally somebody who knew them like yourself or worked with them will come through with these personal stories that humanize them in a way. And I just so right. enjoy it. So it just means the world to me. Before I sign off, I guess I'll ask if you're doing any work these days, or you have any projects, or you're just, you know.
I just wrote a book.
Oh, great.
A book. It's based on the premise of what happens in Oz if Dorothy doesn't show.
Very interesting.
So I've been having a good time with that. I've sculpted some of the characters because, you know, if she doesn't show up, what happens to the Tin Man?
Yeah.
What happens to the Cowardly Lion, you know? The Witch of the East. I mean, if mm-hmm. that doesn't happen, then what, you know? So I've been playing with that for the last couple of years. And then teaching. I still love teaching. I'm about to go back to Berlin and Vienna next month to do a couple more classes. I do those every year. And just, you know, wherever people will have me and want me to go do a class, I'm there for them, you know. And if it's a job, I'll only do it if it's fun.